I've always felt like a strange attraction to the London Underground Railway. And there's just something kind of fascinating about it to me that you kind of, you know, you go down a stairway and then you're in this kind of other world that's in some ways quite strange for 10 minutes. And then you go back up and you're somewhere else. And, you know, that's a very romantic way of describing getting on a train. But I wanted to sort of run with that feeling of like, this is a place that exists not just below space, but like just below reality.
Hello, salut, bonjour. Welcome to The Lost Bay, a show about indie RPG creators and artists and what's behind their creative processes. I'm Iko. Today, my guest is Chris McDowell, creator of the RPGs Into the Odd and Electric Bastionland. Both games share a fascinating, weird, industrial, early 20th century setting and have been extremely influential to the indie RPG scene for the way they handle game mechanics. Chris came to gaming quite early, first through the popular Games Workshop miniature war games.
When I was about 10 years old, I got into Games Workshop games, so miniature war games. To be honest, I wasn't really aware of role-playing games existing at that point. You know, this is kind of pre-internet, obviously. So this was like 1995 or something. One of the games the Games Workshop put out was a game called Warhammer Quest. It had a rule book, but then it also had a book called the Roleplay Book. And it kind of pitched this alternative way of playing the game where you had your players as normal, but then one player was a games master. And this was all new to me at the time. But then it got me kind of interested in that sort of thing. And I sort of fell out of the sort of the miniature side of things when I was sort of a teenager, came back to D&D. So this was around 2000. So when third edition was just about to come out. Yeah. The big thing that appealed to me was the idea that you had all this, you know, it was a fantasy world and everything, but the idea that you could try anything was what really appealed to me. The idea that you weren't limited by just, you know, what was written down on your little character. Third edition was probably like the worst game to try and get into that, because third edition did try and have kind of a rule for everything. I mainly sort of played online to begin with because my friends weren't really interested in it at that point. So I said, I played a few like forum games and games on like on IRC chat rooms. I had some fun playing them, but it felt very much like hard work. I kept thinking, you know, this isn't what I thought this was going to be. There's a lot more minutiae than I was really interested in. So from there, I kind of almost straight away thought, well, you know, it can't be that hard to write a game. I'll just make my own.
So Chris started hacking, tweaking free games he found online until he decided to write his first game, Into the Odd, from scratch. A few years after Into the Odd, Chris released Electric Bastionland. The game keeps only three of the fictional locations of Into the Odd and expands them. Bastion, the infinite, ever-changing industrial city, Deep Country, and lastly, the mysterious underground that connects everything. In Electric Bastionland, there are no classes like in more traditional RPGs, like Dungeons & Dragons, for example. Instead, there are 100 possible failed careers. Each comes with a brief description, a few random tables, and a strange name, like, for example, Criminal Bureaucrat, Alpha Tester, or again, Exposed Imposter. The names of the careers are beautiful, evocative, and they alone picture the Electric Bastion Land strange universe.
After Into the Odd had been out for a little while, I started to see people were really latching onto the setting, which is something I hadn't really expected. And, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do with Into the Odd was to create a game that was very light on rules, but had a lot of flavor throughout it rather than a big complex setting, just lots of flavor in the actual game itself. That idea just kind of organically shifted over time where I thought, well, how can I tell people more about this world? If I'm trying to describe this city, a good way of doing that is through the people that live there and through the characters of this city. So somehow that turned into the idea of having all of these failed careers that your character might have. So having over 100 failed careers, and as well as being part of character creation, these two-page spreads would actually tell you about the city of Bastion and the world around it just by looking at them. Even if you don't read any of the other sections, you can kind of absorb the setting through those.
And I was wondering, did you like design, plan to do 100 failed careers like from the start? Or
it started as like a bit of just a challenge to myself of thinking, well, could I do this? Is there enough meat on the bones of this setting that I can do 100 different things without just repeating myself a lot? Yeah, it didn't take that long to come up with 100 like names for interesting careers. And then the real thing that took a long time was for each one, there are 2d6 tables, sometimes items or sometimes just like weird abilities that you might get. You're going to get one from each of these d6 tables. And they took a long time because it's fine to think of like, it's just a lot, I'm going to be honest with you. And there were times when I regretted this decision as I was trawling through. But it does force you to go to places that you wouldn't necessarily think, because if I was out for a walk and I thought of an item that might be cool to have on an expedition, if I just saw an object and I thought, well, I haven't got that in there yet. Yeah, so and the other place that I would get a lot of inspiration was going to like tool websites, like hardware sites.
Oh, really?
To like a DIY kind of thing. So if you looking through there, and I can see, oh well, this is a tool that unblocks a drain or something. And I'm like,
wait a sec. But was it like a process or a strategy you discovered, or are you like a DIY guy? Do you?
No. I'm not a DIY guy. Yeah, this was just, I was literally thinking about like, I was probably just in a moment of desperation. I was just Googling like list of tools and thinking, what haven't I got in here that might be useful? That's the thing that people seem to like about Into the Odd, is that a lot of the items are things like glue, marbles, and, you know, collapsible poles, all this kind of classic dungeoneering equipment. Yeah, this is kind of that taken to the extreme, where you just end up with all sorts of strange items.
In the setting, like everything is a little bit broken. Starting from the characters you play, no?
Yeah.
This idea of, you know, starting with a character which is already somehow a little bit consumed by life or...
So that kind of came from two directions, really. The first one is a line that I put near the start of Into the Odd. No matter what's happened before, your character has decided to become a treasure hunter. That solves a lot of problems that you sometimes get with sort of D&D type games, where you might have a character where you think, well, it doesn't make sense that this character is going into this dungeon to try and find treasure, because, you know, maybe they've got a family or a career. Or I like just the kind of bluntness of saying, this is a game about going and seeking treasure in dangerous places. So your character has decided to become a treasure hunter. It's up to you to decide why that is. But that's the thing that we all need to agree on. And that worked in Into the Odd. But I wanted to take it a bit further. So with Electric Bastionland, I wanted to really kind of light a fire behind the characters to spur them on and give a bit more of a reason. So it's not just that you're greedy and you want to go and get rich quick. It's that you're in a massive debt, basically, and you have a £10,000 debt. Your characters are probably at a low point in their life because you've sort of taken on this debt. I wanted to sort of remove all options for them other than treasure hunting. So like, maybe you did have a career as a prestigious, you know, there's ones in here that are like, you know, probably quite well-paid jobs if you look at them at face value. But the thing to remember is that you failed at this. It lets you have that be a part of your background. But if you want to move your character completely away from that direction, then you've still got the freedom to do that. It gives you a starting point, but it kind of leaves your future open to the player.
So in Electric Bastionland, when you create a character, you don't choose your failed career. It's random. But its randomness is based on natural abilities, strength, dexterity, and willpower of the character. So you first draw these three abilities, and based on the score of these abilities, you pick your failed career from a table.
The failed career of the character is selected on the table based on the lowest and the highest stats of the character.
Yes, that's right.
How did you choose, you know, how did you distribute the careers, into the stats spectrum?
Well, it's interesting because when you look at like the probabilities on that table, there are certain results that are much more likely to come up. Like some of the results on the table only have sort of a, I think it might even be like 0.01% chance. It's less than 1% anyway. But within that kind of matrix of the different failed career numbers, I wanted to make sure that if you rolled badly, you're likely to get like an item that's an oddity that's really cool, basically. So you're likely to get something that's going to give you a bit of a shining light in there. And if you roll very high, you're probably going to end up with some kind of weird limitation. If you roll very well on your ability scores, then you end up being a set of twins and you sort of split your ability scores down the middle. I put a bit more attention on those middle results where if you roll, you know, 11 strength, 10 dexterity, 9 charisma, then you're kind of just sitting in the middle. And I tried to put in those middle careers that had those kind of average scores, I tried to make sure that they had some kind of identity to grip onto. So an extreme example is like, I think the mockery is kind of in there somewhere, which is like the kind of Muppet equivalent of this setting. So if you think you've rolled a boring character, hopefully your failed career should give you something kind of extra interesting to latch onto.
The Electric Bastion Land universe, and especially the city of Bastion, which is the core of this universe, has a very strong early 20th century touch. It feels odd, but at the same time familiar. Here's why.
I was wondering basically if it's like a period in time that interested you before the game, maybe you read stuff or I don't know, or that was something new for you explored with that game. So
mainly because there's so much weird stuff in the world, I wanted it to have like a very relatable groundedness to it as well. So you still understood this city. You know, it feels like a city that theoretically could exist on Earth. It's a very human city. Like people still have human concerns, and yeah, it allows you to then, when the weird and the horror elements start to come in, it lets them shine a bit more brightly because they do kind of stand out. And early 20th century, I don't know if this is just me, but it feels like the furthest back you can go where things still feel a little bit like today. I don't know how to explain that any better. Yeah, like it's only a few generations ago, really. So we have like, you know, we have photographs and we might have known older relatives that lived in this time and we might have heard about them growing up and things like that. So it's like just at the edge of our kind of personal memory, I guess. You know, there's a certain benefit to having a world that doesn't have all of the technology of today for a role-playing game, but it still feels modern.
The book describes three locations. The first two are the city of Bastion and Deep Country. The underground is the third location of the Bastionland universe.
When I was a child, I remember we went to London for like a weekend with my family. And I just remember keeping the tube map and being quite obsessed with like looking at the different routes on the map, which is a very weird child thing to do. There's just something about it that really kind of appealed to me and sort of enticed me. And I don't quite know what it is. I've always felt like a strange attraction to the London Underground Railway. And there's just something kind of fascinating about it to me that you kind of, you know, you go down a stairway and then you're in this kind of other world that's in some ways quite strange for 10 minutes. And then you go back up and you're somewhere else. And, you know, that's a very romantic way of describing getting on a train. But I wanted to sort of run with that feeling of like, this is a place that exists not just below space, but just below reality. There was a post very early on in sort of the OSR blog days that was talking about the dungeon as the mythic underworld. Thinking of how in some editions of D&D, the dungeon is kind of presented as like crossing a threshold into some kind of other world that exists underneath our own, rather than thinking about the dungeon as, oh, this is, you know, this is a ruin that goblins have moved into and now they live in this ruin and here's how they get the food and here's where they sleep and here's the wildlife. That's one way of looking at the dungeon, but if you think of it more as like crossing the threshold into the underworld, it means you can get a little bit more weird with it, basically. It makes it feel like it's a place that's separate from the rest of the world.
When I read the book, the funny thing is that we discover about Bastion, the city, and I thought to myself, oh, wow, that's a really scary, dangerous and fascinating, but also quite scary place. And then there's like Deep Country. Oh no, that's even scarier. And then there's the underground, and that is even scarier. And the thing is that I have the impression that like evil is really evil. It's so strongly evil. I mean, it's like a terrifying, pure, wicked force. Is that right? I mean, am I like...
Yeah, so the way that I designed each of the sections of the world was almost looking at each section from the outside. What one of the big kind of dichotomies in the game is between, you know, Bastion is the city and Deep Country is everywhere else that's kind of rural. I hope that I've got the authority to do this because I've lived in both a big city for quite a while and I grew up in a rural environment. It's sort of 50 miles south of Manchester. It's the county nobody in England really knows about. So I wouldn't expect anybody else in the world to know about it. But I really wanted to draw on like stereotypes of how each side would see the other. So when you live outside a city, you might think of the city and think, oh, in the city, everybody's just out for themselves. And there's, you know, it's too busy and it's dangerous and everyone's just kind of piled on top of each other. And it's just a mess and it doesn't work. And that's kind of made into reality in Bastion. And then on the other side of it, sort of with Deep Country, you know, if you live in a city, it's easy to think of people in the countryside as saying, oh, you know, it's like going back in time when you go to the country. You know, you get there, you can't get an Uber, the Wi-Fi is really bad. You know, they haven't got all the fancy restaurants that we have in city. They're so uncivilized, these people. And I wanted to sort of lean into that. And it's a tricky balance because I didn't want to put anything outright harmful in there. But like I sort of took it to such an extreme that I'm hoping nobody thinks that it's like legitimately what I believe about rural life. Yeah, so I didn't necessarily want to have like an outright force of evil within the world. It's more a sense of like your fears come true almost, rather than kind of a lurking evil that's gonna sort of that's got some scheme to take over the world. It's more the sort of the fear of the unfamiliar, I guess, really.
Electric Bastion Land is a big book, 336 pages. The rules are packed in less than 20 pages. 220 pages are dedicated to the failed careers, for each career 2 pages, one with the stats of the character and a full page drawing, a beautiful drawing. And the rest of the book is 100 pages of advices and principles on how to run the game and the different locations.
Because the rules are very simple, in some ways that makes it easy to run because you haven't got to remember lots of rules. But it also creates a kind of freedom for the conductor or the GM that they might actually find a bit overwhelming. And they might often find themselves in situations where they think, well, what do I do? How do I adjudicate this thing that they've just asked me to do? Because, you know, that there's no list of rules that tells me how to deal with this specific situation. So I did want to have principles that are going to get the conductor used to making rulings, because, you know, a key part of this style of play is making rulings that feel fair to the players, because that's kind of the bread and butter of running the game for me. I want to be open and honest and say, look, here's the simple system, but also I'd recommend you read all this section about guidance because this will show you how to get the best out of that system. Like so many things in the book, it really evolves from what I actually wanted to have for my own use. Like it's things that I would write down for myself to remember in the game. And, you know, I happen to like making very short bullet point lists to sort of remind myself of things. So yeah, the game ended up being almost entirely 3 bullet point lists. Yeah, very selfishly, but I think a lot of the best design comes from like designing for yourself, because, you know, I could try and design a game for you or for some imaginary person that I think is going to want to buy my book, but I'll never know what they want like entirely, but I know exactly what I want. So it's the only real way that I find I can design.
Let's talk about the art.
Obviously. Oh yeah, sure.
And it's really amazing. There's a lot of it, man.
Yeah,
there's, for each failed career, there's an illustration. And so, yeah, I was wondering, what was the process?
Yeah. So the art was done by Alex Sorensen. And he kind of came onto the project relatively late, which I think ended up being kind of like a blessing in disguise. I was speaking to Patrick Stewart, who designed, you know, Veins of the Earth and Deep Carbon Observatory. He sort of gave me a list of like 12 different artists that he'd seen. I sort of checked out Alex stuff, and I thought, oh, this could be a cool fit. And I got in touch with him. Obviously, he didn't know anything about the game at all. The text was basically finished at that point. I was able to give him this, you know, this pretty much finished thing, essentially what you get in the final book minus the art, I kind of gave to him with just a load of big red squares where the art was going to go. I kind of said to him, like, look at these failed careers and look at like the equipment that you might get, and then just try and draw like a scene that both portrays that failed career. It can be focused on that character, but also I want lots of weird stuff in the background. And, you know, he kind of went off with it and made it his own, really, and brought it to life. And as the pieces started to come back, it was really interesting because they were very different to how I was picturing them in my head, but they still fit really well. And they created a sort of a new angle on the world that I really liked.
Was that a long process?
No, he did it very quickly. I'm sure it was a busy, I think he did almost all of the art in about, I could be exaggerating this, but I think it was about a month.
Wow.
No, that can't be right. You know, I'll find this out, but it was really interesting because he was sending me just the pieces as he was doing them. So like I'd come home from work and I'd have an email with three pieces of art for three of the failed careers. It's interesting because some of the first ones, you can see that it's almost not playing it safe, but for the later ones, you can see where he really starts to open up and he kind of realizes that, you know, you can kind of do anything with this setting and you get some really creative stuff. So, it was a really cool process to go through.
So there are three locations in Electric Bastionland, but throughout the book, a fourth location is mentioned, an inaccessible, distant and alien place that is left very mysterious. It's called the Living Stars.
And there's a kind of a fourth setting suggested in the book. There's traces of aliens, of alien culture, and there's these stars which are very enigmatic and distant and
too enigmatic, some might say.
No, I don't know.
It's more of a source of things that are coming into the rest of the world rather than a place that you would want to go. It's a place where you can have things come from. So there are aliens in Bastion, and it's a very broad category of beings, the aliens. So they can kind of be whatever you need them to be. And I would like to revisit what it actually means to go to Living Stars in the future. But I think it wasn't quite within the scope of this book. It didn't quite fit on the same level. So I left them as kind of this mysterious outside source, if you like.
Chris runs a great YouTube channel where he does a lot of live broadcasts. Watching his YouTube channel, you can get a feeling on what he's working next.
I have things ongoing at the moment, so I've kind of dipped into some miniature wargaming stuff. I'm sort of going back to my roots, I guess, a miniature wargame kind of skirmish game. I've spoken on the blog about an idea called Intergalactic Bastionland, which started, again, as a joke because I just thought the name, it seemed like such an obvious thing to do next would be to do, you know, Bastionland in space. But could we have a game that does explore this idea of the Living Stars? And, you know, I'd want it to be something that you could integrate with your Electric Bastion game, but I'd want it to be its own thing. And at the moment, obviously, we're recording this in April 2021, and we can't currently go and play at a gaming table with friends. And for that reason, I found it very difficult to develop this game because Electric Bastion grew so much out of what I was playing at the table. And I would want the next Bastion book to have the same kind of process because I think it really worked for me and I'm really happy with what it created. So yeah, it's slightly stalled until I can get to a gaming table and actually let it grow sort of organically. But yeah, there will be something to do with Intergalactic Bastion and hopefully at some point.
That was Chris McDowell, creator of Into the Odd and Electric Bastionland, an amazing horror industrial rules-light RPG. The game is available in PDF or has a beautiful hardback book from Modifuse. And as always, I'll put the link to the store in the show notes and on the Lost Bay blog. Chris does a lot of stuff. Be sure to check his blog, his podcast, his YouTube channel. I'll put all the links in the notes.
The Lost Bay is a podcast about indie RPG creators and artists and what's behind their creative processes. It's produced by me, Iko. The editing is by Laura Elle, and music is by Avery Isles. To get updates about upcoming episodes, you can find me on Twitter at The Lost Bay or on Blogspot, thelostbayrpg.blogspot.com. And thanks a lot for listening. Salut!